Chapter 29, Neutral Gear.
I'm about to get serious. No more story. Let's see how well you performed, how well you read me throughout the book, shall we? The book promised a relative lack of intellectual discussion as it demonstrates my mind through scene in prose. To demonstrate rather than explain how my mind works, I do nonetheless feel the need to explain certain concepts now, concepts that may seem alien to most readers. The reader has occupied my mind, at least superficially, but they may have coloured it with their own. Read this section and then the next ones. After you have done so, please read the book again several times from start to finish, keeping in mind the concepts that I'm now about to explain. This book is written to charm you the first time, because yes, superficial charm is apparently such a nebulous concept. Perhaps on second reading you might get the trick. This book was written to demonstrate the workings of my mind, so if you really want to understand someone like me, you should read it again after reading this section. Irrespective of context, you may have read passages that seem strange not only by their content but by their order. You may likely have been intrigued where I seem to express great feeling and drive at times that seem strange. You've seen the stories progress rapidly at a pace that may give others pause for thought. Look not at the scene but the mind, my mind. My mind experienced these events at the speed that they were written. If I seem to skip something that you believe is important, such as checking whether someone is okay, or... Yes, I skipped writing about it because I skipped doing it in reality. If you see large periods of time in the book, sometimes years, in which I have no human connections at all, it's because I didn't. Although I've always had at least superficial human contacts, even when I went friendless for a while. My friendships for me are like waves, yes, in that they come and go. Sometimes they hit the shore. But this was intentional, as it showed how fast my mind progressed through these events. And I've attempted throughout to convey exactly how I thought then. This was done emotionally, stylistically, and intentionally throughout the book. I wrote the book for neurotypical readers in such a way that, I hope, allows them to simulate being me while reading. This is, I believe, the best way to explain people like me, or at least myself. I don't claim to speak for others, which is why I wrote this book. Time will tell, on publication, whether I was successful. The way I live and think is not something that I appreciate consciously on a daily basis, because for me it's completely natural, ergo I do not intellectualize it in any way. This is, to me, like breathing. Writing it in this book intellectually and in a way that might provide clarity for readers was a fun challenge for me. I like challenges, and now offer you one. When you do read it again, note not only the events themselves, but the words. Look at the mind more closely. Look at what I choose to remember. Let me explain. You may have begun to clock several concepts intellectually throughout. Now, I will tell you what I called all of it in 2018, as that was my major introspective period coinciding with the Boring House period. No, it was not mere drama. Pay closer attention. Boring House was your first clue, and the most pure of all chapters. It was definitely my favourite chapter to write. Back then, I called my condition chronic boredom syndrome, a fitting label because it accurately, albeit somewhat jokingly, describes how I work. There is a certain word that people might typically use when describing me, especially in a clinical context, except that I don't meet large parts of its criteria, things like sexual promiscuity and criminal versatility, perhaps childhood delinquency and so on. Okay, the jury may be out on that one. Now, this word and the clinical world around it, made worse now with an even less accurate term, does not describe Leah Rowe. The purpose of this book has, throughout, been to demonstrate my mind through scenery and contrast. The contrast of your mind versus mine. If you notice me completely skip something in the story that you yourself would have, yes, that's the trick. You got it. And I skipped it in reality. The reader may have caught a glimpse of my mind in these moments. Those readers who share my mind, who share my type of mind, will have seen throughout on the first reading, and they likely do not need a second reading. They get it, right? I mean, this book's not for them, though I assume some of them might enjoy it. I mean, I did also write it for them, yes, you, because they might also see themselves in it and be like, damn, yeah, fuck, that's me, holy shit, lol. But, yeah, this book is written for the normies too. It's my masterpiece, yes, let's call it that. Alternatively, I may have referred to my condition as neutrality. This concept is even better. Of course, the clinical world may say shallow effect, such nebulous yet wily. No. Let's talk about my earlier life as an example. 2017. Girlfriend, cat friends, labour, trans groups, and so on. The period described by the boring life chapter, etc. Apparently, this applies to all Well, actually, this applies to all periods of my life, but that period was the most potent for this exercise, as it was the most socially active to date while I wrote this book. Essentially, I was trying and failing to emulate suburbian, but I lacked commitment to any sort of effort. I dreamt of the appearance of it, but most people at this time would have seen that I was just some young yuppie with an odd girlfriend, right? You know what I mean? We later broke up. I was eccentric, and some people believed I might be impossible at that time. I could be quite impossible in groups. I felt completely overwhelmed throughout because I was trying to emulate emotions that I simply do not have, and the pressure of doing that daily was just too much. When you hear about people like me that are being extremely harsh in situations like that, this may be the reason why in some cases, because we just lose our minds, you know, at least I did. It's not because I was mad or evil or whatever else. It's just that I was actually in hell. It's not that I had any ill designs on anyone myself, but I just felt that my life had been imposed upon by others. You know, I felt suffocated. There's so many protocols of behavior that I just did not care for. Girlfriend and I visited several friends that she'd made. There was one couple that we visited in their crappy little apartment. I liked them, but you know, they liked a version of me that had quickly become irritable. I lashed out a lot, often to the point of insanity, and I would frequently shut myself off from others. Now, let me be clear, this was one of the... She was the one making friends. I just tagged along, you know, I would not have made the effort otherwise. I rarely try to meet people in real life, because most of them just don't get me at all. You know, I don't live in their world. I do sometimes meet people like myself, and I sometimes find them to be, well, more satisfying to be around. My girlfriend arranged most social visits, going to people's houses, sitting in their living rooms, drinking beer, playing computer games, going to pride events, etc. I handled the money. You know, I made sure that we were fed. I just tag along, and as she befriended everyone around her. I felt no connection to any of these people. I don't like it when my own life is disturbed. I prefer solitude most of the time, which in retrospect now makes most of that period seem absurd. I simply did not need these people, but they did confirm to me many of the things that I'd always suspected. When I experience people, I understand at an intellectual level that they have different hobbies, jobs, they live in different houses, eat different food, they have different political beliefs, different whatever. You know, I learn to appreciate the subtle nuances of opinions and things, and I'm very good at quickly understanding the sensibilities of each and every person that I meet. However, I experience them all in the exact same emotional register, as if reading schematics of two different circuit boards, comparing their parts and rewiring them. This may sound ridiculous, but I only experience individuals intellectually. Every person I meet elicits the same neutral response. For this reason, I never feel like I have one special person. Now, I can prioritize certain people if they give me better sex, more food, more things. Let me put this another way. When you walk into a supermarket, every orange is the same. They look and smell and taste exactly the same, and that's how I experience people internally. I do not experience individuals as separate emotionally. That is, I intuit their emotions quite well, without actually experiencing them in real time. I build complex models of people in my mind as though they are living in a house called Lear Row. The version that I have of them may not match the real human being, and in the past, my models may have been wildly inaccurate. Over time, though, I would have much better training data. This year, or that year, 2017, was my first real year interacting with people outside of a controlled environment like, say, school or conference. I never felt the need to socialize with people during my early to late teens, because outside of school, you know, I never went out with anyone. My Dutch friend was the first person that I'd ever dated, really, if you could even call it a date. I had earlier experiences, such as my various jobs, and of course, school was also a major part, but 2017 was the year when the human, called Leah, was first put to test, and that Leah failed. The one writing this book has evolved a lot since that time. I understand that they're separate, but I don't feel it. You know, even if I've known a group of people for a long time offline, you know, I may read their online chats, for example. This is a good way to demonstrate it, because yes, the words coming out of your mouth verbally are to me a stream of text. You all feel emotionally like plain text to me. I can reliably observe you. I know how you're feeling, but you will not alter my own emotional state in any way. My own mind is not without feelings, but they are largely egocentric in nature. I do not automatically think about other human beings on anything more than a superficial level. When I model a person, I can understand their emotions intellectually, but when I read or hear their words, I'm processing them through my neutral brain. I do not love, for example, and I've never experienced what people describe as empathy or remorse. Not physically, although I emulate them with logic. This concept of neutrality is alien to most people, and it's why I felt the need to explain it, contextualizing the main prose. I hope that as you read more of the book, you may remember it, because this fact is constant. It remained constant, and it will remain constant throughout this book and beyond. As I once wrote in older journals, I'm neutral even about my own neutrality. I am not necessarily even happy or sad about it. It's simply a fact that I deal with as I please. I've been like this since as young as I can remember, even when I was like 4 years old. My neutral mind existed when I was four. Let me be clear. I probably had it since I was born, but I don't really remember much before the age of four. And obviously anything before the age of 10 is a little bit blurry as well. But Cat Friends, for example, did not escape this fact, though she was genuinely awesome and probably still is. Assuming she's still alive. I lost contact with her in 2018. The somewhat absurdist tone of this book has been written with the approximate the kind of charisma and charm that I may deploy verbally from time to time, especially in scenes. And in the way I write them, I tried to perfectly recreate them as they were, all things considered. I'm neutral then too. I was neutral. I was neutral the whole time. I was neutral while writing this book. My mind almost never leaves neutral. When I was younger, I didn't mask at all. You know, I was often regarded as robotic by classmates and teachers in school, although their chosen word was aloof. You will notice the overly austere tone in these explanations after all of these stories, which may have seemed intense. What you've just read is the actual tone inside my mind. This paragraph and this chapter, and some earlier parts of this book probably, when the way I write suddenly seems a bit off, a bit perhaps dry and cold, that's neutral brain. You're reading my neutral mind. My mind sounds exactly like what you're reading at all times. Let me be clear. You sound like this at all times. Things and places often do too. I myself even come across as neutral to myself in my own mind. I can feel sometimes, but sometimes my own literal self is neutral about itself nearly all of the time. I am not a robot, though. I want to make that clear. There is a specific term that people use to describe me, but I regard it and other terms currently existing as inadequate. I will cover them in the next chapters. There is no medical terminology or socially accepted norm for me that I currently regard as respectful of my right to even exist. Again, wait until you read the next chapter. Neutral does not mean robotic. This sounds like a contradiction, but it's true. I can feel extreme pride in my work, for example, and bliss as I go about my day. And I can feel joy or depression. I think it probably just depends on what I ate that day and how much stress I have. I'm happiest when I have fewer burdens, of course. Just like anyone else. When I can just drift on all day on whatever hobbies I like. You know, this is the same for everyone, but most people are more complicated than that. With me, this is all you get, and it's fleeting. It happens in short waves, and then it's gone. You know, I'm not describing dissociation or depersonalization. I'm fully aware at all times. Imagine it like a car that won't start. My engine might start for brief periods of time and then stall again. It's extremely difficult to convey this conceptually, especially for neurotypical readers, and I'm confident that a lot of people will misinterpret this entire book, especially this chapter. Here's another hint. When you reread, notice how when I describe the places that I go to with such reference or disdain, how often do I talk about the people I meet? How much do I focus on them? You may start to notice a pattern. Take Flower Girl, for example. Do I write at all at any point about what she's like, her personality, what sort of person she is at more than a superficial level, how I feel about her? Ask the same for any other character in this book, even girlfriend. I never hated her personally, only the situation that I was in when she was around. You will notice when I describe people in this book that I skip entire sections about them. This kind of the kinds of things that a neurotypical person would experience with people that are simply not written in this book, and it's not an accident. My mind simply did not have those experiences at all. So I can't write about them. I will not write about something that did not exist. I once told my mother that I care for her, but not about her. It's the same with everyone else. I actively make an effort to care for others when it seems appropriate, although I can become annoyed about it as well. My mother is actually a perfect example. She's been suffering with chronic pain for several years due to spinal issues. I moved back into my parents' house in 2022, and I still live there as I write this. I have listened to her writhe in pain constantly, on and off. I've heard her pray to God and ask for death. I've seen her scream in pain. She has done this in front of me, tears pouring, and I feel nothing. I can watch it in pure bliss, thinking about something else entirely. My mouth will still output the correct sequence of words to comfort her, and my body will still make her a cup of tea or anything else she wants. My mother is a special person. She's my mother. I don't feel loyalty to her or anyone. I can show loyalty. I don't feel an emotional need to care for her, and I will forget she exists sometimes. When I was younger and I went to scouts trips, for example, where I'd be away from home for weeks, I wouldn't think about my parents at all. They simply didn't exist until they picked me up from the camp at the end of the summer. I don't love my mother. I never experienced love. I never will experience it. I probably won't experience it anyway. I told her that if she were to die, I'd simply arrange her funeral, attend the funeral, and think about her. Which is true. I would do all that's expected of me. She's my mum. My loyalty to her is not based on emotions of any kind. It's implemented on a purely intellectual level. It's simply a contract that we have as humans. Of course, there are people who have bad parents who will quite rightly cut off all ties. I have good parents, and I reward them with my undying loyalty. This is not out of love. There is no feeling behind it at all. I simply do it. I will continue doing it until they die. I have an excellent mother. If motherhood was a contest with a score of up to 100, my mother would score 100. I could not have asked for a better one. I don't feel grateful. I still thank her for all the help, but there's no feeling behind it. Same for the word sorry. I never feel remorse, so the word sorry is meaningless. There is nuance, though. I do actually feel comfortable talking to my mother. She understands several aspects of my personality, especially relating to empathy. My relationship with her is largely healthy, and she is one of the people that I'm able to talk to and not feel strained. I enjoy her company. I once experienced at some point in 2025 a brief glimpse of what I might feel in the future after my parents are gone. They were merely away for a few days, but I had the house to myself. I went shopping locally, as always. I felt a sense of loneliness, not that day. Not a sad kind, but a pervasive emptiness. It was similar to what I'd experienced earlier, like in 2016, but I was under complete calm, without stress of any kind. It was just a calm loneliness. I caught a glimpse of how I might feel all the time in the future, unless I build relations now. My parents are the only ones that I have a relationship with currently, besides some people I speak to online, and not in Libreville either, just some people I know. I do have my party politics as well, but with them it's just all politics. There's no real friendships there. The feeling occurred while I was shopping. Just shopping. You know, I was completely calm, and the shop was quite packed that day. I felt completely serene, and I just felt like I was the only person in the world. It did not make me feel sad, necessarily, but it did feel strange, and it has informed my plans over the next few years. The years creep up on me faster as I can sense them as I write this. 10 years is a long time. I don't know how else to explain it. I simply caught a glimpse of my future that day, and I did not like it. My neutral future, as it were. My neutrality, though, is not limited to others. It's applied also to myself. I often do not even think about myself at an emotional level, one way or the other. I take achievements in strides, same for failures. When I have a deadline fast approaching, I'm able to ignore it, not even with any sense of panic. I'm a fog. I always have been. My business is a perfect example. I've managed to keep it running for over a decade, and I make good money, but I rarely get anything done on time. If anyone orders something from me, I sometimes take a week to ship it. It's not even that I'm overwhelmed or overworked. I just catch up with work, and I can catch up with work really quickly. But because it's my company, you know, I want to keep running it. I want to ensure that everything does ship relatively on time. But sometimes your order will be delayed. The reason is because I'm at home. I'm working on whatever I want. I'm thinking, I'm staring into space sometimes. Sometimes distracted by just a completely new hobby. I'm constantly thinking. My mind never stops. This book is an example, as it distracted me from all other much more important tasks while writing it. I ignored most of them, many of them serious. I can be quite irresponsible and reckless even now, although it's rarer now. I considered this book important, and I would not stop writing it until it was done. I'm also not without discipline. I always pull myself back and catch up. Often, though, I'll try to find someone to do work for me. You know, I love it when someone wants to do work for me, especially if I'm paid. Free software gives you some of that privilege, for example, because people just want to use your code. So someone will always take over if they want to. I think with little regard whatsoever for my own health or safety most of the time. It's not that I'm going to ride my bike recklessly, for example, and run through traffic dangerously. These things do not give me much of a thrill. No, I simply do not think about myself most of the time. I don't exist. I'm a fog. I can laugh and smile at times. I can get angry at times or in instances where that is natural. But my intellectual and emotional self is largely flat. Who I am in this regard has remained constant throughout my life. It's not that I don't exist, but I'm also not there. I just live in the moment. If you ask me to describe myself, I will actually struggle. I literally do not know who I am, as it were. I know my name. I know where I was born. I know what I do for a job, where I went to school. I know the people that I've met. I wrote this book as proof of that. Although, through it all, you know, I'm the same fog. I am also an orange, for want of a better word. At the same time, I also have long-term goals. I want to eventually live in my own house that I own and do not rent. I could have done so earlier in life. My wealth decreased as things got more expensive since my 20s, which meant that my real-time wealth has evaporated. As I write this, my current literal plan for the future is this. Buy a house in the northeast of England or somewhere cheap in Finland, where house prices are also cheap. Go off-grid and with solar and winds, insulation and storage heating. Minimize use of water, except for drinking and showering. Organizing pipework for long-term maintenance. Between this and eating cheap, near expired food or from food banks, my living costs would then be near zero whilst also having freedom. Once I've done so, I would then do very little work or none at all. Even going on benefits, if possible, would satisfy me. I have greed, but not material greed. I have time greed. You see, I want to live the most, I want to have the most maximum amount of free time possible, irrespective of money. I want it for a very specific reason, namely so that I can think freely and drift for the rest of my life. This is my dream. I've had it since I was 15. I write this because you'll see people say sometimes that people like me can lack long-term goals. This is false. I have goals and discipline. Parts of this book will even show that. I have no plans beside this. I did not, for example, imagine meeting a new partner or having a family. There is every chance that I may repeat the experiences of 2016 to 2018 where I had to find a new partner. I've been drier since 2017 as I write this in 2026. I have not even sought relations. There are no relations in my future. No people. I may meet them and they may enter my orbit. I'm not going to say that I'll be nice to them or mean to them. I will be Leah to them. That's what I'll be. There is no pretense. I'll do what I'll do. You know, whatever that is. It will probably be something completely boring and benign, as it is with most people. Gender reassignment surgery cut my sex drive to near zero, which I considered to be a kind of freedom. I even articulated this at the time in a video that I made while I was in Thailand, recovering from my surgery. I am no longer a slave to my own body. I control my own mind. Sex was the only aspect that I sought in previous relationships, and so because I don't need sex, I now no longer need the prerequisite romance. This is not to say that I do not experience lust from time to time, but it's now at a level so low that I can essentially ignore it. As a result, I am now much stronger than I used to be mentally, because I'm no longer controlled in this regard, hence my freedom. I was freed from sex. This may sound ridiculous to some people, but it's true. This is literally how I think. What about ambition? In this lovely northern English home, presumably a former council-owned terraced house, I do not live to old age. I do not think about retirement, even in an economic or social perspective. I simply exist now, and I will continue to exist until I don't. I have no concept of growing old, even when I know this to be true at an intellectual level. My body has started disobeying my mind already as I write this. I know that I'll become old, but I don't think about it. I just don't think about it. I told my mum once that when I die, it'll probably be at my desk. I'll be alone in a house, doing something at my computer or something. The smell will begin to offend my neighbours, and the local services will break in to retrieve my corpse. I have no benefactors. My assets and wealth will go to the state as well. I am a registered organ donor as I write this. When I die, my body will be cut up and used for science. This seems to me like the most efficient use of an otherwise useless corpse. This seems most appropriate to me. You can do whatever you want to me after I'm dead. I do want to live a life as comfortable as possible while I'm alive. What I fear the most is crippling illness or disability, loss of control. Were I to develop dementia, for example, I would wish that the state simply put me down. I fear the loss of my intellectual freedom. I want to reduce my responsibilities and long-term risks so that I can essentially retire young. My greed, my lust, is indeed an intellectual and creative one. I told someone once that all I want to do is keep expanding my intellect and creativity, learning new skills and working on new projects. I'm a creative and I enjoy making things. I don't lust after things made by others. They all imply a duty of some kind. A car, for example. Cars require heavy maintenance and they carry huge financial burden. My physical freedom matters, but my intellectual freedom is what I value most. Many people value things, people and their relationships therein. No, I want the freedom to think. If I want to, I could become the next Albert Einstein or Pablo Picasso or something, as ridiculous as that sounds. All of this is the same concepts. My emotional neutrality or chronic boredom syndrome, someone who I greatly admire, whose book I also have, Patrick Gagné, suggested a new medical term to describe my condition, low affect disorder. I don't not like the word disorder, but this is at least less offensive and it's more usefully accurate, in my opinion. And most other words and discussions around them will look at certain symptoms. For example, they may discuss criminal versatility and other such things that are, in my opinion, a function of one's environment and not neurology, necessarily. Poverty, for example, creates more necessity for crime, and this may lead to more violence. Neutrality is boring. I've attempted to kill boredom at times, usually failing, although I've found fleeting moments of relief. This book told you about some of my daring exploits when I felt most alive. I mostly accept, though, that I will always be bored most of the time. I live with boredom. I'm neutral about being bored. I'm neither happy nor sad about it. I'm simply bored. I state as a matter of fact that I am chronically bored. I'm not depressed. I'm not dissociative or anything. I'm fully aware of my feelings. I'm just bored. Because I'm bored and rarely stimulated by anything, I'm often irresponsible, or I can be. I've matured a little bit as I've aged, but I rarely feel a jolt when I complete a task. I will complete a task as a matter of duty, but I do often falter. My office, for example, is rarely cleaned. I rarely file taxes early. I always file them just on time, right up to the deadline. I never do anything on time if I don't have to. I regularly shirk responsibilities. My natural tendency is to just float around this earth, going wherever my whim takes me. I can be kind on a whim. When I give people things, and this book has showed several examples, I do it because I'm bored. It doesn't alter my emotional state. I just do it. Shadow effects. Well, this is what I describe here. I gave major examples in this book, but there's something much more mundane. Here's another example. Much more mundane example. There's a woman I know. She has a son. And I've known this woman since I was a child. I regularly see her at a local shop where she works. And I ask her how she's doing. I ask about a mum. I even ask about a dog when I'm feeling really wily. I don't care. I have the same neutrality, and my natural instinct is to not ask at all. I simply get in, get what I want, in this case, pay for my things and leave. Simply asking how someone is doing is something that I've learned to do at a cognitive level. The answer is something that annoys me more, usually. She'll tell me about how her son is approaching college or something, or some other aspects of her life, feeling great pride. The events themselves are mundane, but most people experience them emotionally, so they feel. This is how most people relate to each other. Like, I will nod, I'll smile, I'll even laugh, but I genuinely don't care that she or her son exists. She is the neutral stream of text in a sea of text. The world is, to me, plain text. I'll still give my giddy little giggle and a smile, and I'll wish her well in my charming Southeast Essex accents, and as I leave the shop and go home to cook a lovely meal, I'll then offer to make my mum a cup of tea. If I'm not acting, my neutral tone of voice is flat. I don't sound like a robot necessarily, but my tone remains constant, and my face is as stone. I've alluded to this neutral face at several points in this book. This is my neutral state, and that is my neutral state at all times. This is just how I naturally am. I can laugh and smile, I can genuinely be happy for myself, but when it's around other people, no. I've never really been in any trouble with the law, though. You know, my parents, they raised me well, and I'm too stupid to become a criminal. I don't need to break the law or the rules. Breaking them still leaves me neutral most of the time, unless it's something major. But I don't really want to go to jail, so I don't break the law. You know, I'm not clever enough to get away with it, hence I'm too stupid to be a criminal. There are other ways to get my kicks, and you know, I'm getting older. I don't really want to face heavy consequences. I get tired a lot more now, so I'm just bored. I just accept that I'm bored. If this feels repetitive, it's intentional. I'm writing it this way to show you how bored my mind is. I'm bored with boredom itself, and boredom is boring. Boring is bored. Neutrality is neutral. It is neutral, and if your brain does not work this way, then you probably have no idea what I'm talking about. I'm a flat tone. Imagine that my brain was music. My brain is stuck on the same note. It might occasionally come unstuck for a while, but it always comes back. It always gets stuck again. Sometimes when I'm in actual serious danger, I may become cathartic and even feel a buzz, quite intensely in some cases, but this is fleeting and rare. I accept it at an intellectual level. So I made a new friend, and his name is Boredom. It's intoxicating. I'm probably boring even you now, so let's talk shop. Every other book will wax lyrical about how they're pro-social. Fuck that. No, I do not need permission to be myself. I'm simply bored. And that's all there is to it. No, fuck that shit. I'm not pro-social. I'm not reformed. I'm not self-controlled. I didn't write this to please anyone. I write this to educate everyone. There's a difference. And I never think about victims. I don't think about my benefactors. I don't think about people that I've helped. That lady whose job I ruined, probably because, you know, I drove her to raid and then, you know, failed to prevent her from being sacked. She had gender reassignment surgery 6 months later. She got it by crowdfunding after losing her employment health insurance, obviously. I didn't feel anything. I didn't even laugh. I did donate $1,000 to her crowdfunder, reasoning that this would add plausible deniability in case she ever came after me. She could not resist someone who was being so generous. Then I basically left her alone. She meant nothing to me. I only found the link to her crowdfunder because someone from her former employer felt sorry for her and showed me it out of the blue. That lady who I made relapse to smoking in 2011, and she'll be in her 30s now, she could even have cancer, for example. My lovely neighbour from 2018 may have the same in store for her. I'm sexually attracted to women who smoke and wanted to watch them smoke. Loss of control is an additional component to my sexual tastes. BDSM, whatever. I mean, I don't really indulge in it that much, but I like watching women who become psychologically enslaved by a variety of methods, this being but one. This is why I made them relapse. Most people who quit don't know that if they take even one strong drag, they're hooked again. So, you know, I'd watch them the next day. I'd become aroused watching them, but then they're gone. I don't even think about them after that. Those two blokes that I threw out from Libra in 2021, no idea what happened to them. They were both poor, and they were using Libraboot as a means to establish their own commercial presence under my guidance. They had people in the chat room send them things to work on, for example, and I had apparently set up an arrangement with them, allegedly, where I might send them products as well. It was all fine. Until one day I got really high while listening to one very specific part of a trance playlist. It just tickled the right part of my brain, and they were gone the next morning after 5 years. That last part is something that I've tried to, you know, fix because I've wanted to keep people, but I like it when people help me improve my projects and improve my work. And I credit them. You know, I praise the name. I make sure everyone knows they exist. Good work deserves respect. I praise them, the people that are removed. Their names are still in my hall of fame, as it were. It works both ways. I can help someone. I can leave a person happy instead of making a victim. I don't make a habit of doing either. I do what I want. You know, it may just happen that I benefit someone or hurt them. I don't think about it. I may give something to someone if I'm obliged or forced, or I may hurt someone if forced. I don't really want trouble. You know, I want peace in my life, so I try to avoid trouble. I won't think about it though. You know, once it's done, it's done. You can't really go back, can you? You know, whether it's good or bad. So I just keep living life forward, you know? I never really think about the past because it's literally pointless. I only thought about it for the purpose of this book. I don't think about it otherwise. I may think about the past when planning my future, though. I mean, some people say that I and others of my kind often lack the ability to learn from mistakes. No, false. I learn plenty. What, do you think I'm stupid? Fuck off. Oranges, though. Even friends are oranges. People that I've known for years. Oranges, by way of the previous analogy. A better way to think about it is like colorblind people. I am, by way of analogy, colorblind to other people's feelings. Now, a colorblind person may adopt methods of identifying a color that they can't see, but they will never actually see it. I have developed ways to anticipate the emotional state of a room, but I do not automatically feel it myself. It's as I said, you're plain text. Every person that I meet is plain text. It's as if listening to music, but all I have are the notes. Empaths, meanwhile, hear the music of humanity. I only have the notes, and I studied them fastidiously. This is harder to do, and in fact, empaths sense feelings from others much faster than I do. Oranges, though. I am often colorblind, even to myself. I can be my own orange, as it were, at times. A lot of the time, though, I'm not using emotions at all when thinking about myself or generally going about my day. I'm not describing depression, and I'm not describing dissociation. I'm describing my neutral mind. I am aware of myself and others around me. I remember all of it. I sometimes feel intense emotions, but I do think I'm probably a lot less emotional than most people. It has especially become truer as I age. I don't get nearly as angry these days, and things that used to excite me also feel much more mundane. I'm becoming much calmer and more rational as I age, although that's probably true of most people, so I probably won't really think much about that. This book has provided several accounts of both kind and sadistic acts. I don't go out of my way to do either, as I said. It's opportunistic, mainly. I don't get out of my bed and decide to be a bastard. I don't decide to just hurt a random person. I have a sadistic streak in me, but I rarely use it unless I'm in the right type of mode. Same for kindness. You know, I don't wake up in the morning and decide that I'm just going to be kind. I'm neutral. When I wake up, I take a piss, I eat breakfast, I have coffee, I have a shower, I brush my teeth, I do my hair, I get dressed, I read, I watch the news, I might go on IRC, I might check up on a few projects, I do work for the day, I work on projects, or I'll go somewhere for the day, I go to a Green Party meeting, perhaps, I'll do me all day. I might do you, one way or the other, if the situation dictates, but I'm mostly just going to do me. I'm a very me person. I need a reason to be kind, an incentive. Same for sadism. I need to know that the profit justifies the cost. I might sometimes do either on a random whim, if I have nothing better to do, although I do that a lot less now. I sometimes have nothing to do myself, or things are going so well at the moment that there's just nothing on at the moment, and I'll just roam the world in my calm fog. I'm an engineer. I like building things because it distracts me from the fog. I really like thinking about complex systems, mapping them in my head and building them. I take pride in seeing things that, you know, come to life through code. But it works elsewhere. You know, I enjoy admiring photos of electronics projects that I've worked on, mods and repairs and so on. I enjoy looking at artwork that I've produced in the past. I sometimes enjoy the work done by others as well. I can feel extreme pride in my work, and I just admire it for hours, sometimes other people's work as well. I'm the architect. I see the world as inherently beautiful from an artistic and scientific view. When I go places, I love admiring the architectures of cities. I love Paris, for example. I enjoyed Hamburg when I was there because of how functional everything is. And it just reminded me of the UK a little bit. Everything works a little bit better in Hamburg than in the UK, though. Hamburg is my happy place. I see beauty in order. When I work on software, the thing I like doing the most is auditing code and making it efficient. I like solving problems. I see the music of the world. I don't necessarily feel it or hear it, but I see it. I do see it. People don't concern me so much. There's an entire world out there that I find beauty in. I like things. I like systems. I possess a highly analytical mind. I often catch patterns that people miss, and I'll just think about a system for a long time. I possess a highly visual and photographic mind. I can write code in my head and think about it in my head. Sometimes I'll revisit a project after months to test an idea, after just processing it in my mind. That's the kind of person I am. You know, I think like a scientist about everything, including people, even though I know people are a little bit more complex than that. I just model them a little bit better over time. But I can like people. I often like to befriend highly intelligent people who have a similar artistic or engineering mindset. To me, they're both the same thing. All of my long-term friendships, and I've had several long-term friends actually, are on a purely intellectual basis. It may be that the other person feels something for me, but with me it's all logic. I seek intellectual and creative novelty. I like smart people. It's that simple. I enjoy working with people on projects. Social contexts do not concern me so much. I will handle the latter as best I can, but I prefer to just build the world around me and possibly make a bit of money doing so. I possess, and I say this without arrogance, a high intellect, and I enjoy using it. I'm also confused a lot of the time. People can confuse me. Throughout this book, I've relayed stories that may suggest I'm in control. Like I ruled the world, perhaps. My own small world, anyway. I control myself, but others are still a mystery to me at times. After a while, the same people start to drain me. You know, when it goes beyond the superficial, the professional, the courteous, and when it comes time to really connect, that's when I start to fall apart. You know, when people want things from me emotionally. I have no intentions one way or the other, but I have no models of people besides the largely surface-level relations that I've built. I've become better at dealing with people over time, but I still become drained when I'm around them for too long. My own needs start to take precedence. And some may consider that a person like me is to be envied, but they may not consider that because I don't feel these connections, that my boredom is ever pervasive and overwhelming. When people need me on a deep level, I just start to break. It's that simple. I used to deal with this tension by simply avoiding people.
I still find it soothing now to be alone, but and alone is my happy default. But I do make the effort, you know. I don't generally try to emulate people the way that I did before. I know that this can't be sustained reliably, so I just don't. I'm neither happy nor sad that these limitations exist. They're simply there, and I have an intellectual understanding of them. I'm still me. A lot of the reason I used to stumble a lot was because I tried to be something which I know I'm not, or nor will be. The result was that I'd often become highly stressed over time, and I'd sometimes lash out at others. This part does not concern me as much as the consequences for me personally. And this started in 2018, in the period described by the Boring House chapter. I am boring. I'm not suppressing anything, nor trying to emulate anything. I'm quite unapologetically self-interested and self-driven. On relationships, for example, I know that most other human beings are not compatible with me on more than a superficial level. I know that there may be some who understand the way I think and they will accept me. But I know that it's just not possible for me to have a healthy long-term relationship with, a deep long-term relationship with most people. I'm much happier these days as a result, and I focus on my strengths instead. I focus on my work, for example. I'm good professionally, so I focus on that. I know that my interests can be fleeting. Contrary to what some people might say about us, a lot of people like me are not power hungry, at least I'm not. I actually considered what might happen if I ruled the world, for example, or perhaps less grandiose, became the British Prime Minister, or something like that. My conclusion every time is that I would just get bored and step down. I would not have the drive to keep going. I don't need praise from others, and I don't need their permission to feel self-accomplishments. I gain satisfaction from my various intellectual pursuits, most of them solitary. I sometimes meet people who like my work, such as Lieberroot, and that's nice too, but it's all for me. On politics, for example, I can become quite active in an election campaign, and then quickly lose interest once it's over, withdrawing entirely. I keep up a presence at meetings when I can, but my mind's just not in it some of the time. I just do not experience the world emotionally the same way that they do. And I sometimes just have to focus on myself. Myself. That's the key here. This was the reason I failed in the past, because I tried too hard to focus on others. I learned the hard way how they trigger me, how certain aspects of my personality, namely my anger and aggression, can be brought out depending on who I'm with. I'm much more aware of it now. But awareness alone is awareness is all I can do, and it's sometimes not enough. Intellect can only take me so far. I am still human. Consider that as I write this, I'm not even halfway through my life, if national statistics are to be believed. I'm 34 as I write this. I will probably change over time in ways that I don't predict now, but the overall concept of who I am now will probably remain. I have several more decades of crippling boredom to contend with. I will need to fill that boredom somehow. Projects like Lieberroot can fill some of it, and I can always find some other random hobbies to sink my teeth into. Hobbies are one of the main ways that I cope. I'm what some people might call a psychopath or sociopath. I find these terms incredibly unproductive, especially given the conversations around them. I feel that a lot of out psychopaths act like caricatures of sorts. There is just so much drama about them. This is why I only mention these terms at the very end of the book. I got annoyed when a lot of other material that I read, they talk about being pro-social this, reforms that, self-restraint that. Nonsense. Absolute nonsense. Not all of them are like that, but a lot of what I've read is literally like that. You know, these people compare themselves to the neurotypical, even when they claim not to, and others, and they other themselves, and by extension, they other me. I don't want to be othered. There is no accurate medical terminology to describe who I am. As I write this, in a way that does not also want to end me or call me a disease. What I want is for people like me to have the freedom to be themselves. This does not mean going out and causing mayhem, no. I just want us to be free. It's like trans people. I also happen to be transgender. I want transgender people to be free to self-identify as whichever gender seems most appropriate for them, transitioning the way they wish to, and if at all, expressing themselves and just living as they want to, without being talked down to. I want freedom in both regards. The term psychopath or sociopath mean nothing clinically now, but pertain to so-called treatments in most cases, not acceptance. They, and modern terminology like antisocial personality disorder, require that I also be extremely violent or show criminal behaviour. Much of it is based on research done in prisons. I don't meet vast swathes of the criteria, and I'm sure that I would probably fail formal diagnosis. Yet I have the same lack of empathy, lack of remorse, dear impulsivity, shallow emotional depth, all that good stuff. I also have long-term realistic goals. I lack of delusions about myself. My writing might indicate grandeur at times, but I see clearly. I'm not perfect. I'm a fully sane and rational human being, most of the time anyway. Don't let me fool you otherwise. You know, I'm in no way intellectually or morally impaired, and I'm in full control of myself. I'm usually quite boring. A lot of the people that I meet might say that I'm charming at times if I'm not masking. They'll think that I'm aloof and I'm off in my own little world, which I often am anyway. But that's besides the point. Yeah, there's this one woman that I know of, Patrick Gagné. She wrote the book Sociopath, a memoir. I've actually got the audiobook on my computer now as I read this. I'll continue listening to it after I've finished erasing this. Anyway, I've watched a lot of her videos on YouTube as well, and she coined a new medical terminology, low effects disorder. I like this because, as I've explained before, because it's much less offensive and it's much more accurate, it's much more specific. In any case, there is currently no competent medical handling for people like me that actually exists in practice, at least in most parts of the world. I will say, though, Patrick Gagné being the exception because she actually knows what she's talking about. I will say, though, that a lot of people who probably have a brain like mine who might cause a lot of trouble, and in most cases, I'll bet it's because they don't have the right environment. You know, this is one of the things that Gagné talks about as well. They may not be even aware of who they are, and so they have no intellectual basis on which to guide themselves. I say labels are unproductive, but they can be extremely helpful, but they need to be accurate. And if someone does want help for it, like it has to come without strings. It has to be that the individual with these brain quirks, yes, quirks, I don't call this a disorder, it's a quirk, they must be free to choose the life that they want. Now, obviously, this does not mean that people should be able to go around raping and killing each other or whatever, but within reason, you know, within the law. I think that there needs to be a lot more discussion and education about so-called psychopaths. Let's just call it what it is. You know, when you hear the term successful psychopath, pro-social psychopath, reformed psychopath, high-functioning psychopath, these are deeply offensive conceptually, in my opinion. They're judging someone without giving them any agency over what sort of person that they want to be. Now, let's go back to trans people. Again, I'm trans. Again. I'm also non-binary. I do not strictly identify with the female gender, although I mostly present female. This book has presented me as female because it's just easier. I also don't care if someone genders me female, and all of my documents are female, mostly because the UK just does not recognise non-binary people legally anyway, even if they did, as some countries do, for Ireland, for example. Other countries don't. It's just easier. But, well, wouldn't it be nice if I was able to actually express who I am, gender-wise, in a legal sense, without such bureaucracy, right? And it's the same with psychopaths. Well, now, traditionally, treatment for gender dysphoria has meant conforming to a ridiculously strict set of criteria. The WPATH criteria comes to mind. Living in a gender role, dressing a certain way. In other words, someone else is telling the trans person in question what sort of person they can be. If you can then pass as male or female, whichever way you're going, you are now successful. You are a fully assimilated trans person. You can conform to your gender role. But modern research indicates that gender is a spectrum. And in my opinion, so too is psychopathy. No two psychopaths are the same, and I've met several people who I would absolutely regard as inherently psychopathic, for want of a better word. Humanity itself is a spectrum, so singling out psychopaths or trying to cure them, as current clinical context dictates, usually in a criminal context, in this case exclusively, it's basically the same kind of erasure. It's almost like conversion therapy. We are a minority after all. It's the same argument. In fact, as I write this, I looked at Emmy Thomas's YouTube channel recently, and she recently had the idea to create a psychopath awareness month. Perhaps this book can be part of that. I don't know, but education, education, education. It's got a nice ring to it, no? I've seen a lot of people online, mostly YouTube, talk about how they're such and such. Yes. Guess what? If all you're going to do is read off the Robert Hare checklist and do videos for clout saying that you've done this, you've done that, and you're not, and all you're going to get is weirdos. You're just going to get nutters. You do yourself a disservice, because all you are at that point is a condition. You are not a condition. You're a human being. I bet most of you are interesting and decent people, most likely just normal. This isn't even really an insult, you know, it's just life. As for myself, you know, what about me? Well, I mean, there's just the part of my brain that's probably got the volume turned down. There's just something in my mind that just doesn't turn on. That's all this is, you know. It's like the old, you know, those old TVs that you had to tune in. I'm like the TV channel that never tunes properly. You might get a few glimpses every now and then, and it's a bit blurry and a bit garbled, but it never quite gets there. And who I am is the result of my environment and how I was raised. And I like to think that I've used my time on this earth to my own benefit. I became self-aware when I was 15 years old because someone called me a sociopath on a forum. So I looked it up. Yes, I checked all of the boxes, all of them. And I still do now as I write this book. I found it funny at the time, but I just went on with my life. I mean, what else was I going to do with that? If I had to summarize it, my mind's might be divided into four separate priorities in terms of how I operate. So this is a little bit sterile, but there's basically my neutral state, right? Most of the time I'm neutral, but I sometimes find ways to alleviate boredom. I enjoy control of myself and others as necessary, and I do occasionally enjoy certain thrills. Ever fleeting, of course, but these have already been discussed in the book, so there's no real need to go further. Yes, I'm a bored robot orange. I also think the term masking is generally problematic for another reason. When someone identifying as a psychopath claims that they mask, they may also delude themselves into thinking that certain emotions or feelings aren't there, which is to say they may claim to mask when in fact in some cases they might not be. I'm not a neurologist, I'm not a psychologist, I can't speak with any authority there, but I don't necessarily believe in binary representations of anything. My intuition is that empathy is not a binary. Some psychopaths might actually experience weak or intermittent empathy as opposed to an absence of it. I don't actually, and this is something that I'm going to touch on for myself as well, I don't think it's actually possible to completely lack empathy, but I could be wrong. I know that with me, it's turned way, way down, but I do sometimes have flashes of it, which the next chapter will briefly cover. Only briefly. Because, you know, there's not much action. You don't really need to explain this stuff. I've already done it thoroughly in the book. I wrote this book for me, to analyse myself, and as an exercise for the reader, because everything else I've read, or most of whatever else I've read, is crap. They give an overly academic, largely medicalized account of their lives. Alternatively, they may be extremely hostile. A lot of these books that I've read and a lot of these accounts that I've read, they start with a letter from a therapist or something. Or they say they're diagnosed. Some of them are therapists themselves. I mean, that's fine. You know, I'm not knocking it. But some of these people, whether they know it or not, they may just reduce us to a checklist. Now, I've wanted to do something different with this book, because I'm not a checklist. I am me. I'm complex. I have complex emotions and thoughts. I do complex things, and I have a highly active professional life. There's a lot of nuance to my life, and I have passions on things that interest me, like Libreboot, computer science, more generally linguistics, arts, all sorts. I'm all over the place. You know, there's always something that interests me. I'm also into politics. Oranges, though. You are all oranges, and so am I. You all look, smell, and taste exactly the same, and so do I. I know that you're all different, but I don't see it. I don't want to see it. I like not seeing it. I know that I never will see it. It's just a difference in how I'm wired. I was born this way, or at least I probably was. I also happen to really like oranges sometimes. I enjoy eating them. Oranges are good. I want more of them. The more the merrier. I hope you found this book useful. I would encourage you to do a lot more research on this subject if you haven't already. As I write this, there's a lot of change happening. There will also be a section at the end of this book that references some of the sources that I've used. As I write this, there is a change happening with lots of people like myself coming forward. We need a lot more public awareness. You will notice how much I ranted in this chapter, which may have seemed delusional at times and overly grandiose. I wrote like that intentionally for this chapter, but this is how I sound inside my head sometimes. It's also how I sound online. There's nothing glamorous, though, about who I am. I'm a normal, boring person. I've sometimes contemplated how a neurotypical person might feel if they had my brain for a day, and then returns to their own brain afterwards. How would they feel about it? To me, this is normal. It may work the other way as well. If I had an empath's brain for a day, I'd probably go insane with my life's experiences, because I've got all these things that I just haven't dealt with, and I'd suddenly feel about them. So, yeah, no way. Nothing glamorous, though. You know, most of my days are completely ordinary. I wake up and I just do work or errands. I watch TV, I read, I go somewhere. Just normal human things. You know, I often feel pressure from daily demands like anyone else, and I have to make sure that I eat 3 square meals. I maintain human relations as anyone else would, especially as I'm dealing with other people on a daily basis. I have long-term friends who I chat with, all of whom know me. They all know my personality. They knew many of the things that are in this book before I wrote it, because I told them. They remain my friends precisely because they accept me. I learned the hard way many years ago that I should just be myself around other people. Myself is often boring at times and often ordinary, mostly anyway. Readers probably expected bodies, given the title of this book, but there are no bodies. There are normal human mistakes which I may have processed on a completely alien emotional basis, I'm not all that different. I can experience regret when the consequences of an action might hurt me in the future. I was reckless with money during my 20s, and I pay for that in my 30s. There are interesting people that I don't talk to anymore, who I could still talk to if I hadn't been such an asshole. Related to both of these is the fact that Libra Boots, while excellent in its own right and loved by many people, has not gone as far as I'd hoped. I can pinpoint all of those times in which I could have taken the project much further in different ways. The way I deal with regret, though, is to simply do those things that I would have done. There's no time for regret at an emotional level. I simply keep living forward. I accept every aspect of my life as it has evolved, as simple facts. And I'm constantly seeking to improve myself. I also did some good things for myself, and I live a life in relative freedom compared to most people. Most people don't have something like Libra Root. I continue working towards the realization of my dreams, like any normal person. Knowing that I'm still going to die in the end, you know, but I'm going to keep going. Why should I do anything else? You will have seen throughout this book that my life is extremely mundane. Such was even alluded to directly in earlier chapters of this book, and now you have your proof. The novelty of this book is not the events, but my mind. It's been both a gift and a curse, but I don't think much of it either. You know, I'm just me. I don't even have a full concept of how different types of people will perceive this book. It's what I can tell you is that I feel normal. I personally feel like, to me, this is all normal. I can say without delusion that I've lived a completely normal life relative to my own brain and environment. Once again, I'm completely boring, and I hope you are entertained. There's a lot of media sensation about people like me and that make us out to be such and such. Many others of my kind may fall victim to it themselves. And that's precisely why I wrote this book. You know, I want to show the world how thoroughly boring most of us are, or how boring I am, at least. A few others like me have also written their own literature. I'm not the first. I'm not the last, either. I will now get a few last things out of the way in some follow-up chapters before you reread the book. It's important.